Israeli soldiers operate with such a level of impunity that they think they can, for a laugh or for a light, they can actually publish online their own crimes. What's happened with the genocide in Gaza is the fact that it is a genocide, and therefore the crimes are so egregious that are being carried out. The attempt to cover them up and whitewash them, as has been done for a very long time, is failing. You're quoting a state that is, at the very least, you just said, accused of genocide by the world's largest institutions. So it seems very odd to take the word of the war criminal, right? I mean, Netanyahu has a warrant out for his arrest.
Since the 7th of October and Israel's war on Gaza, now widely labeled a genocide, Western media coverage has come under intense scrutiny, particularly for the language and terminology used by many outlets. And as a result, the coverage by many Western outlets has been accused of bias against Palestinians, effectively providing cover for Israel's war in Gaza. Now, to delve into this, we're speaking to Asal Rod, an Iranian-American scholar of the modern Middle East and fellow at Dawn, and she's made it her mission to call out misleading headlines. Her widely shared posts earn her the title of Headline Fixer, turning this into a trend of its own online. And she joins us from California. Asal Rod, thank you so much for taking the time to be on Real Talk.
Thank you for having me.
There's a lot I want to get into, Asal. I think the first question, which makes me quite curious, I mean, you're one of the first, if not the first, to start, you know, correct misleading headlines on social media. And it kind of started becoming this trend online. What made you start doing this, if we actually take it from the top?
Well, I actually started doing this before the Gaza genocide. So this is where I think it's become more of a noticeable or something that people have seen shared online a lot more. But before that, and this goes back a few years, for instance, to Israel's attacks on Gaza in May of 2021, I was using the same kind of headline corrections. And I don't even always use it only in the context of Palestine and Israel. I've used it more broadly in terms of like US foreign policy vis-a-vis the Middle East. But the main, you know, purpose and reasoning behind it is when you look at that more broadly, when you look at US foreign policy and the way that the media expresses that foreign policy or tells us that story, especially when it comes to the Middle East, and particularly when it comes to the issue of Palestine and Palestinian liberation, it is very much framed in a way that echoes the sort of political discourse rather than sharing the truth of the story. And that was one of the things I wanted to get at, was this idea that our media is supposed to be, or at least our press, right, journalism, reporting, that is supposed to be something that challenges the state narratives, that challenges what a policy might be and tells you the truth of what is happening. That's how you have an informed citizenry. That's why it's a foundational part of a democratic system or a democratic country. And I'm certainly not the first person who's corrected headlines or has taken issue with the way that Western media frames political issues. But as someone who's studied the region and studied its history for a long time, that was always the thing that stood out to me, was the fact that when the general public had information, their views would be different. We see that now with the Gaza genocide and the way that social media has had an impact, particularly TikTok has had an impact. And the fact that now you see, you know, the lowest support in the US populace, this is a recent Gallup poll, the lowest support in the United States for Israel in 25 years of that question being asked on the Gallup poll. So that tells you something about how important the framing and the information that people receive is, and how skewed it's been for such a long time. So it was really about correcting that narrative so that it reflected the truth rather than US policies.
And what has this experience taught you so far? Your takeaways from it?
I think the main thing that it's taught me is exactly what I was just talking about. The fact that if people were informed about what was actually happening, their opinions on things would be quite different. The US is an overwhelmingly propagandized in terms of its support for the state of Israel. It borders on being a fanatic point of view politically, right? Even if you look at the kinds of language that is used, that's commonly used, that we never question, something like unconditional aid to Israel, unconditional support for Israel. These are turns of phrase that our politicians use without question. And they become, because they become repeated over and over again, it, and that's essentially how propaganda works, it becomes something that no one ever questions. But if you think about it for just a moment, if you remove yourself from the fact that you've heard that phrase over and over again, what, why would it be unconditional? Of course it should be conditional. I mean, US law dictates that military and foreign aid is conditioned. It's conditioned on whether or not the country that we're providing the weapons and military aid for are carrying out gross human rights violations, or if they're carrying out war crimes, or if they're blocking humanitarian aid. All of this is within US domestic law, let alone international law. So the idea that it would be unconditional is on its face problematic. And yet we hear that phrase used over and over again. You hear a phrase like, Israel has the right to defend itself. And yet you never hear in that same political discourse that any other state in the region has the right to defend itself. Lebanon has the right to defend itself. Syria has the right to defend itself. You never hear that kind of phrase. And so what this has taught me so much is how important the language is, how important the choice of word is, how important a simple headline is in the way that people receive information and how it shapes their views.
Like you say, like, you know, I've heard you say this is that the reality is that most people don't read beyond headlines. And that's why it makes it such a powerful tool within an article. But what if someone says, you know, if they just read what's in the rest or what's in the bottom, they're going to see what you're highlighting at the top, basically.
Well, first of all, you don't always see what I'm highlighting at the top, because even in the body of the article, there's a lot of that language is still being used. Now, there might be, and there are certainly really well investigated, well written articles within Western media about every issue, including Palestine. There's certainly those articles exist, but the overwhelming
Sure.
narrative is one that is framed
It's
in a
about the
particular.
larger trend.
Absolutely, because what happens is when you have those sort of exceptions to the rule, it creates the image that no, look, this is a, of course this is a free media. Look at this like article where everything is written out. The fact that there's international institutions and organizations saying that Israel, for instance, is deliberately blocking aid. If they would just read the article, they would see that information in here. But the problem is, a lot of articles are paywalled. A lot of people don't read the articles. And like I said, on top of that, the overwhelming narrative is the other way, right? You have instances where certain language is completely omitted. Words like genocide, occupation, ethnic cleansing, like that language isn't even used within Western media. You never see, even though you might see it even in Israeli media itself. Like I've seen Haaretz pieces that refer to settler violence in the West Bank as Jewish terrorism. You never see that kind of language used in Western media. So there is specific language that even within the body of the article is still omitted. And then on top of that, there's the fact that it's overwhelmingly biased in the other direction anyways.
Well, that was going to be one question that I was going to ask you in the conversation, which is what have you been seeing in Israeli media itself in comparison to Western media? And we can unpack this right now if you want, since you mentioned it.
Sure. I mean, Israeli media, I also don't want to paint a picture to say like Israeli media is not supportive, for instance, of Israel's war efforts. It certainly is. But what you see in Israeli media is more criticism of the state of Israel and Israeli officials. That's, I think, one of the biggest differences that you see. The best example of that is the way that the ceasefire negotiations, starting from what we're almost looking at a year ago, starting from May of 2024 under the Biden admin, if you look at the way that that story has been told in the West versus how that story has been told within Israeli media, it's two completely different versions of events. Because in Israeli media, there is very clear, consistent stories that criticize the Netanyahu administration in Israel, him individually, as well as other officials, and the fact that he has been sabotaging the ceasefire talks from the beginning, that he never wanted to end the war, that the hostages have been sacrificed. All of this kind of language is very common within Israeli media. You do not see it on the Western side. If anything, most of the framing in terms of ceasefire is that it's some, it's either that both sides are having difficulty negotiating, or the blame is essentially on Hamas. And because you see that language from U.S. administrations, especially under the Biden admin, that repeatedly said, the ball is in Hamas's court, right? This is how it was framed. There was nothing that criticized Netanyahu and the fact that he was sabotaging agreements, the fact that Israel has violated the ceasefire that has gone into effect since January, repeatedly violated the ceasefire. Even that language, like the language of violation, that's not used. So you get a different picture of things. The fact that there's protests going on in Israel, how the hostage families have talked about the Israeli side of handling the ceasefire negotiations, none of that is part of the conversation that's happening in Western media.
Do you think that this would surprise Americans?
I would think so. You know, I mean, it's hard to say, obviously, anecdotally without data to back up. I think what we can say that we have support for, I mean, anecdotally, I can tell you that's what I've experienced. I've experienced a lot of people who have said things like, I can't believe, or even not even personally, but when you look at stories online and people who are sharing stories online, whether it's on, you know, TikTok or X or other social media platforms, you have a lot of Americans sort of showing that kind of shock as to what they didn't know. But statistically, if you want to back it up with data, there's the Gallup poll that I mentioned, the fact that there's a shift in the US attitude towards support for Israel. You could look at protests in the US, whether they're campus protests or protests, you know, in large cities, Los Angeles, New York, Washington, DC. You could look at the protest movements that affected the 2024 elections. All of these things sort of back the idea that there is clearly a shift that is happening within the discourse and within the way that Americans have been affected by seeing these images. And specifically, you can also see it by the way that the lawmakers have attacked a platform like TikTok, right? They're openly talk. There's, you know, a clip of former Secretary of State Antony Blinken
Blinken
speaking.
with Romney, yeah.
Absolutely. And they're basically saying it outright. They're saying how important this narrative is, and TikTok is a threat to that. But what is the threat? What's happening is TikTok is giving an opportunity for people to see the reality of what is happening on the ground. And it's very difficult to override these horrific images of men, women, and children that are being slaughtered on a daily basis. And to try to use, you know, sort of language gymnastics to override those images. And they understand the power of those images and the power of these platforms. And that's why they've tried to suppress that speech as well. In addition to the fact that we're seeing, you know, repression of protests, crackdowns on campuses. And now, of course, under the Trump administration, the fact that you're actually seeing green card holders and legal visa holders, people who are allowed to be in the United States, having their visas and green cards revoked or deporting them based on the fact that they are exercising those very rights.
I'm going to read you a few headlines, ones that you've corrected as well, but I'll see what your takeaway from it just hearing them back. So let me start with this one. This is from Reuters, and it says, "Destruction, lawlessness, and red tape hobble aid as Gazans go hungry." That's one. And then this is from the New York Times, "Strikes pound Rafah, flatten large mosque." And then this is from AP. "Israel's refusal to withdraw from this narrow strip of desert could threaten the Gaza ceasefire."
So, on the first one, there's the fact that there's no mention of Israel whatsoever, right? As if Israel plays no role in the aid that is going in and out of Gaza. And now, in fact, since the ceasefire, we saw a lot of aid getting into Gaza all of a sudden, which inherently admitted the fact that it was Israel blocking aid all along. If that wasn't enough evidence, guess who decided to block aid a couple of weeks ago? Again, Israel, right? So it's very clear that it's a switch that's controlled by Israel. And yet, when you hear a headline like that from Reuters, it makes it seem like this is somehow outside of the control of Israel. It's lawlessness, it's chaos. There's no context as to where that lawlessness and chaos is coming from. Not only is Israel blocking aid, but the other aspect of that is part of the sort of notion of lawlessness is coming from the way that Israel is attacking and destroying the entire civil system and infrastructure of Gaza. So that plays into it as well. And yet Israel is omitted from the headline. The second thing I'll point out about that one is the word Gazans,
As opposed to Palestinians, right.
as opposed to Palestinians. And this relates to the New York Times headline that mentions Rafah, right? Because there's certain language used in a headline that erases, I mean, when you say Gazans, you're erasing Palestinians. And that is intentional. The reason being is you see how these issues try to be separated out. The West Bank is its own issue. East Jerusalem is its own issue. The Gaza Strip is its own issue. When in reality, they're all connected because they're all Palestinian territory and they are the territories that would make up a future Palestinian state, right? At least if you adhere to the two-state solution, which is not what we're talking about right now, but in terms of the connectivity of these pieces of land, they are all Palestinian land and they are all belong to Palestinian people. And so when you say Gazans, it makes it sound like that is somehow separated from the larger issue of Palestinian statehood and freedom. In the New York Times headline where it says Rafah, well, where is Rafah? Like, how would an average reader, unless you're very familiar with what's going on, unless you know the geography of, first of all, you're assuming that they know the Gaza Strip is part of Palestinian territory. And secondly, you're assuming that they know that Rafah is part of the Gaza Strip, which is part of Palestinian territory. So there's a lot of avoiding talking about the broader issue, right? You compartmentalize the issue to make it seem like, for instance, the timeline itself, the fact that we the narrative sort of starts on October 7th as if nothing was happening before October 7th. All of this is to buy into the narrative that Israel is in the position of victim, that the Palestinians are the aggressors, and that there's no history that exists of, say, decades of occupation, which is the core of the issue. When we talk about apartheid, when we talk about genocide, when we talk about bombings, detentions of Palestinians, all of the issues that you could think of, evictions from houses, bulldozing houses, all of it is rooted in the occupation, right? If all of it is the fact that Israel is an occupying power, it is, and Palestinians have been under a military occupation for decades, and that's the context that they're always trying to avoid. And that's when you separate these pieces out in this way, you avoid talking about, well, what is the real issue? Right. If you focus on Hamas, then you ignore the fact that Hamas comes into existence in the late 1980s, but the occupation predates that by decades. So this is the way that the language that is used is meant to sort of focus, laser focus on something so that you're missing the forest, right? You're missing the forest for the trees. The intentional focus is on the trees rather than the bigger picture.
And is this a deliberate strategy in your view?
I mean, absolutely. The idea that this is something that is happening, say, like by accident, is absurd. There are articles and people, journalists who have come out of platforms like the BBC, the New York Times, CNN, who have talked about the internal dynamics of their newsrooms and the fact that they felt that they weren't allowed to say certain things or write certain things. You have the fact that there are leaked documents from the New York Times that are directly instructing their reporters not to use certain language like genocide or occupied territories or Palestine.
Ethnic cleansing, yeah.
Yeah, all of that is by design. And when you look at that, and then you actually look at the raw data that's in front of you can see how it's playing out. The thing that you can look at on top of that is the way it compares to other conflicts. So the way, for instance, the Russia-Ukraine war is talked about is quite different. The language that's used to describe the language that's used to describe Israelis is different than the language that's used to describe Palestinians, right? An Israeli soldier is described as a hostage. A Palestinian child is described as a prisoner, even though both of them have been detained, right? But one is a hostage, and the other is always a prisoner, even though they're children. There's no charge, there's no crime, and eventually they're released. So all of those things, all of that is meant to dehumanize Palestinians in the process, right? Where you have Ukrainians are talked about differently, Israelis are talked about differently. Palestinians are dehumanized, so that their deaths and their killing are seen as less important or less significant to report on.
Yeah, and I actually have this was an Intercept study to add on to the point that you're making right now. So the Intercept recently published a study, I think it was the last year. It was saying that Israeli deaths were mentioned 16 times more often than when they were Palestinian, and the term slaughter was used by editors and reporters to describe the killing of Israelis versus Palestinians 60-1. Massacre was used to describe the killing of Israelis versus Palestinians 125-2.
Yeah. I mean, there's no, that's why I say there's no question to it. I mean, when you actually look into the data, it's very clear that it's, that that's what's there. It's, and this is why I talk about the idea of a free press and a political discourse. Whatever is the policy seems to be what the sort of corporate media, right? This legacy mainstream media, that's what we're talking about. Obviously, there's all of these independent media organizations that now exist that challenge that narrative. But a lot of people, because some people will argue, well, you know, nobody really reads the New York Times anymore, or nobody watches CNN. There are generational differences, certainly, but that's not true, right? That's not a true statement. Obviously, there are people who are reading the New York Times. There are people who are watching CNN, or else those institutions.
And they still carry influence as well.
Absolutely, they carry influence. The fact that the way that we get information, the passive way that we get information, and that's why I focus on headlines, that's what helps shape the way that we think way more, especially as a general public. Like, if you are looking into an issue, any issue, with any great detail, then you're going to have a different understanding of it. But when you're a passive observer, then you're just getting little snippets, bits of information. And it's those bits of information that you're seeing, you know, if you're sitting at a cafe and CNN is running and you see a headline under, you know, the headers that they put on. If you're scrolling on a social media platform and there's a New York Times post and you just see just a few words, those are the passive things that most people are picking up on. And that's why that piece of the language is so important.
I wanted to ask you about going back to the point that you were making about Israel blocking aid. This, I want to talk about framing and the importance of framing a headline here. And if we take that particular example, I think of, let's say, one example would be, you know, Israel is blocking electricity or blocking aid to pressure Hamas. Or the UN will come out and say that Israel's blocking aid. And then you'll have a news headline that would say, you know, the UN accuses Israel of blocking aid, which Israel denies, or something along those lines. Talking about the importance of framing here.
Because they're trying to justify it, right? It's not Israel is blocking aid and this is a violation of international law. The fact that that's a war crime, that is completely absent from it. You actually see, and this is within the headlines themselves, you actually see them trying to justify Israel's action rather than reporting it as what it is, which is, you know, a violation of international law. Or when, you know, the accusation, it's always an accusation. It can't be that Israel is committing genocide, right? You can't just say Israel is committing genocide, which is the global consensus of, you know, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, now multiple UN reports, right? There are multiple UN reports that say this is genocide. Genocide experts, people who study genocide.
But it would be framed as that they're accusing Israel of genocide.
They're only ever accused, right? Because when something is an accusation, then it casts doubt. So there's always this idea of casting doubt on something that Israel is doing. On top of that, within the same headline, it's Israel denies this, or Israel calls the UN anti-Israel or anti-Semitic, right? All of this is to undermine. So you're helping the headline is helping to undermine the international institution. It's helping to undermine Amnesty International or the United Nations. And it's really interesting because you're quoting a state that is, at the very least, you just said, accused of genocide by the world's largest institutions. So it seems very odd to take the word of the war criminal, right? I mean, Netanyahu has a warrant out for his arrest, period. He is a wanted war criminal. This is the way to describe this person. And you're taking the words of a wanted war criminal and you're using it to cast doubt on what, you know, a committee of the United Nations is saying. So it creates a situation where it's as if Israel cannot do anything wrong because they can only exist under accusations. They can only, even if they are accused and there is evidence, well, they deny it. I've seen pieces where within the piece itself, it'll go through multiple paragraphs of, you know, why Israel targeted a certain place and multiple people ended up being killed. Multiple Palestinians are killed. Israel says they were militants. Israel says they were targeting Hamas. Israel says they. So you'll see multiple paragraphs like this. And at the very end, it'll say they provided no evidence of that. Then why are you reporting all of it? Why is everything that they're saying being reported? And then at the very end, you're telling me everything I just read, you have no evidence of. So it's a very bizarre way of presenting information, and you don't. And if you think about it again, you don't see it in reverse. You don't see articles where, well, Russia says they were targeting so and so and so and so in Ukraine, and at the very end, you'll see something that says, "Well, they didn't provide any evidence of that, but most of my article is based on what they said."
But what if a news editor from these organizations comes to you and says, well, you know what, I reject this notion that there's a systemic bias within these newsrooms, and that what is actually happening is that we're reporting, a 360-degree view of what is a very complex story. What would you say?
Their job is to report the truth, not what people are saying. I mean, that's like the most basic thing, right? You always hear, I don't know the exact sort of catchphrase, but it's, if it's, you're not supposed to report, person X says it's raining outside and person Y says it's not. You're supposed to look outside and see if it's raining. You're supposed to report the truth. It doesn't really matter what these parties are saying, because in fact, there's a difference between state media. Right, they can say what they want to say. That's why they have press statements. That's why they have foreign ministries. That's why we have, a State Department in the United States. Governments can say whatever they want to say, but the job of a free press, and I say that because we champion this idea in the West that we exist in, the liberal world as opposed to authoritarian societies. We have a free press. The job of the free press is to question and challenge that, or else you end up with a situation like we did in 2003 with the invasion of Iraq. Where, and that's now a matter of record. Like that's historical record. Everybody knows that there was a concerted effort by the Bush administration at the time to create basically lies, fabrications in order to justify its invasion of Iraq. And the job of the press was to tell you, was this true or not? But they didn't do that. And so that helped create a public sense that if you look at polling back in 2002 and early 2003, the majority of Americans believed that Saddam Hussein was either close to or already possessed weapons of mass destruction. Now, you can blame the American public for not being informed, but it's not actually their fault that they're not informed because the channels through which they're supposed to be informed did not give them the correct information. And that's why it's so important that the job of the press is to report the truth, not to report what everybody is saying.
And do you still see the organizations that we talked about, legacy media, let's say, do you see them still functioning as a free press?
I obviously don't want to draw, a parallel as if they're operating in the same way that state medias are operating in authoritarian states. But there should be a lot of cause for concern. I mean, if you look at the broader political context that we currently are living in the United States, and you talk about authoritarianism, it's not just about the free press, right? There are other aspects of this that are playing out as we speak. The how checks and balances that are written into the system, how are those actually operating? How much power does the executive have? The questions about free speech and the right to protest, all of this is happening in real time. And while you see some sense of urgency on the part of the press to sort of question that and then understand their own significance within that system. When it comes to certain topics, they play into that very situation. And so I don't want to say that it is the same, that it is operating as, say, a state press, but it is not operating as a free press, if that makes sense, right? It's not entirely on one side, but it's also not operating the way that a free press is supposed to operate. It is also not telling you, it's not telling you the story. It's telling you a curated story that just happens to reflect the policy positions of corporate interests and the US government.
And I'll tell you why I asked the free press question. It's because I've noticed on your social media, you share a lot of articles and headlines from The Onion. And I wonder if that is part of a vision or a way of you seeing that their headlines are a lot more accurate than if the idea is satire doing a better job in truth telling than mainstream media.
Well, satire to a certain extent is supposed to be truth-telling, right? I mean, it's being self-ironic and it's criticizing, it's doing two things at once. It's criticizing the media and the way that the media is telling that very story, but also the story itself, right? It's criticizing, say, Israel's policies for the way that they're carrying out their genocide or war, whatever military operations they're carrying out. It's criticizing that, but it's also criticizing US politicians. It's also criticizing how the media operates, that it doesn't tell this sort of raw way of telling the story. I use The Onion, and to a certain extent, it is still parody, but it's not. Some of the headlines have been eerily accurate for what is actually happening. There are moments where the line between satire and reality has been completely blurred, I think, when you look at the articles on The Onion.
How unprecedented is this time that we're in for a scholar like yourself, and I'm talking specifically in terms of media coverage of Gaza in relation to what is actually happening on the ground?
I don't think it's unprecedented. I mean, if you look at it from a historical point of view, but propaganda has been around for a very, very long time. The sort of famed book by Edward Herman and Noam Chomsky, Manufacturing Consent, that book was published in 1988. So it's clearly not new. And even before you had social media, and even before you had televised media, just think, if you go back to World War II and Nazi Germany, if there was widespread propaganda to justify the atrocities and the Holocaust of that state, it didn't need TikTok to do that, right? So there's ways of spreading information, disinformation, misinformation. All of those things have always sort of been there. But when we're looking at a more contemporary history of how this particular issue has been portrayed, I think what's happened with the genocide in Gaza is the fact that it is a genocide, and therefore the crimes are so egregious that are being carried out. The attempt to cover them up and whitewash them, as has been done for a very long time, is failing simply because of the level of atrocity.
And is it ultimately about impunity, in your view? The idea that all of these atrocities can be documented, knowing that there will be no consequences?
Well, just think about the fact that a lot of the images, a lot of the evidence that is being collected of war crimes is being collected from social media posts of Israeli soldiers. Israeli soldiers operate with such a level of impunity that they think they can they can, for a laugh or for a like, they can actually publish online their own crimes. I mean, look at how many images we've seen of Israeli soldiers in women's lingerie, or destroying homes, or laughing about blowing up buildings, playing with children's toys. I mean, it's the amount of footage that exists because they're the ones sharing it. And that is now being used abroad, when Israeli soldiers are traveling abroad, as evidence for, war crimes being committed. And so the steps that the Israeli state has taken is to tell their soldiers, either A, stop posting things, or delete your social media posts before you travel abroad. They're not telling them not to commit war crimes. They're telling them stop publishing it online, or at least, delete the paper trail before you travel abroad. But that, to me, is the greatest sort of illustration of impunity, that you believe that you are so immune to accountability that you can actually boast of the war crimes that you are committing.
I'm curious, just I'm thinking as you're speaking right now, I'm wondering what kind of conversations are you having behind closed doors, arguments, debates, maybe with colleagues, maybe with members of the media, maybe with members in academic institutions of what's happening on the ground right now. Is there any particular conversation or debate that sticks out to you?
I mean, I think I see a lot of agreement, if anything else. I think the criticisms will come from some of the things you've said yourself. Well, it's obviously still nothing like an authoritarian press. It's not a state press. There are still really good articles. There are journalists doing really good work. I don't disagree with that. I'm not saying that there aren't journalists doing really good work. There are journalists doing really good work. I mean, outside of just looking at headlines and the written part of the stories, I've also followed State Department press briefings. where you have a room of journalists who are asking questions, and the State Department spokespeople are meant to respond to those. And you see that there are journalists who are trying. They are trying to get at the answers. They are questioning I was going to say logic, but really they're questioning the illogic of what they're being told. But there's only so much that individual journalists can do. It's the institutions that I am criticizing. It's the institutions that are problematic. It's the editors that are higher up. It's the higher ups who are giving these dictates that say, hey, don't use this kind of language, where you're not allowed to use this kind of language. And so it's more of a systemic problem than it is that of individual journalists. And I think that's one of the big pushbacks that I get. And I always try to add that language here, to say this is not an attack across the board. This is not, a wide net to say, there's no one doing good journalism, or that you're blaming reporters and journalists themselves, but more so the institutions that do not allow them the space, that normalize this kind of censorship or this kind of bias. It's become so normalized that it's hard to even question. And I hope that that's what we're seeing now, that we're starting to question the sort of inner workings and the logic of, well, are you sure that it makes sense to frame it this way? Like, why has this become so normalized to now say things like Israel is blocking aid to pressure Hamas? That extra sentence is normalizing the first part of it, as if to say that it is a legitimate tactic and not collective punishment, which is what it actually is. So how did we get here? And can we sort of criticize that and break it apart without attacking sort of everyone under the sun?
And how effective have you been seeing this? And I'm talking specifically about calling out these institutions, these organizations. Do you feel like social media has played a role in influencing the media landscape right now when it comes to criticism and calling them out?
To some extent, yes. I mean, you can say it on a couple of in you, I can say I've seen it in a few different ways how it's manifested. So you'll see updates on headlines, either as a social media post, right? They'll go back and there'll be an original version of a headline. I've even seen headlines that have been updated multiple times because there's so much pushback from the way that the original headline, I mean, it's so terribly framed, and you get these kind of backlash on social media. We've even seen, and this is on Twitter or X specifically, community notes on headlines, right? You'll see like BBC with a community note, which I think is fascinating, because imagine you're the institution that's supposed to be telling the truth, and you're now getting a community note because you didn't manage to do so. Like, that's not journalism. If you're getting a community note, you're not doing journalism. You're not reporting facts, because someone had to come correct you in the way that you framed something. So those are ways, I think, those are very clear manifestations of how public backlash has affected the way that these media outlets are operating. There's also a negative side of it, though, right? If you think about the BBC documentary that just got pulled, this was a few weeks ago, it was because of the sort of backlash that they got. But they pulled that documentary despite the fact that it's if you were talking about if you're going to say if you're going to show the Israeli side of something, if you're going to embed with Israeli soldiers who, again, stand accused of war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide, then why is showing a documentary of the other side problematic? Again, because it shows you this sort of idea that you cannot humanize, you cannot show the other perspective, as if the other perspective is in and of itself not legitimate to begin with. But if you're showing both sides, then at least show both sides. There's something that doesn't add up, if you understand what I'm saying. It's like either stop embedding with Israeli soldiers, because that doesn't make any sense, because you're only getting one point of view, or then why are you pulling this kind of a documentary? Then this documentary shouldn't be problematic. Or just tell the story, tell the truth. Don't embed with them and don't show this documentary. Fine. But you can't have it sort of always. You can't embed with Israeli soldiers in Lebanon, not be allowed, right? Israel hasn't allowed foreign press into Gaza this entire time. Why? What there this is theoretically called the only democracy in the Middle East over and over and over again, and yet they don't allow press into Gaza. They don't allow international investigations into war crimes. They don't allow They're cracking down on not only Al Jazeera, right, within within Israel and the West Bank, but also Haaretz. They're cracking down on their own media as well. So this is all part of the story that, again, rarely gets told on the Western side. And then all the information that is coming from a state that's clearly engaging in war crimes and at the same time repression of information is being shared as if that information is factual.
On the part of the community notes that you were saying on X and the idea of social media having an influence on the media landscape, I'm wondering, and I wanted to ask, how much you think this also influences public opinion, because there was a Gallup poll that you actually referenced in one of your articles. I think it was a Zeteo article where it showed that only half of Americans believe that half of Americans think more Palestinians have died than Israelis in the war. So that means the other half doesn't think so. Was it with a statistic like that? I mean, what does it tell you about public opinion?
Yeah, I remember. I'm trying to think of when that poll was from. That poll was from last year, and I think it was something like half of Americans couldn't answer if more Palestinians had died than Israelis. And this was at the time where I think we had surpassed the 30,000 death toll threshold in Gaza. 30,000 Palestinians had been killed in Gaza.
That's correct, yes.
We're not even talking about. You're not talking about comparable numbers at all. So how can you have something that's so lopsided and then half of the country doesn't know this information? I think obviously, again, social media plays an important role in getting information, but I don't want to oversell the role of social media because again, it's just another media platform. It's also social media is also a place where disinformation and misinformation is being played over and over again as well.
And it's also American-owned, well, most of the big platforms as well. So they can be subject to some kind of censorship, like what we've seen.
They are obviously right. Though if you look at the way that Meta, for instance, has gone after Palestinian accounts or Palestinian activists and how they've censored information, this is why TikTok was the target of sort of American lawmakers because they understood that they didn't have the same amount of control over that platform, and so this information was getting out to people. They were seeing these images of just horror after horror that was happening in Gaza. So, I think that social media definitely plays an important role, but it's a whole media landscape that we're talking about, right? We exist in an ecosystem. You're not just on one media platform. We're in it, especially if you're in the West, you're in an entire ecosystem where, you're hearing what the political discourse is, you're seeing what's happening in popular culture, you're seeing what's happening within the news media as well. And it's that combination that creates and shapes those opinions. And that's why you have half of Americans who are basically ill-informed. And it's not the only topic that they're ill-informed on. This is sort of like a repeated statistic. There's another one. There was a poll by Brookings back in, I want to say, 2021, where most Americans falsely believed that Iran possessed nuclear weapons than they believed that Israel possessed nuclear weapons, which it actually does. So these are basic facts. This isn't, we're not, it's the same thing of when we go back to 2003 and Saddam Hussein either had or didn't have weapons of mass destruction. These are facts. But the public perception is coming from that ecosystem. And that tells you how skewed that ecosystem is.
You've touched on this a few times in the chat, but I want to revisit it one more time. As a scholar of the Middle East, we've seen quite a lot of resistance in U.S. media and Western media in general to kind of place Palestine or Israel-Palestine within the historical context. I mean, why is there so much resistance to that?
Or because it completely contradicts their own narrative, right? If you actually look at the history, there's no way of denying the fact that Israel is an occupying power and that Palestinians are indigenous to the land. So in order to avoid, and that's the crux of the debate, right? That's the crux of the problem. And in order to avoid that, you basically ignore that any of that history exists. And you see a sort of microcosm of that, a micro example of that is precisely what has happened since October 7th. This idea that nothing before October 7th justifies October 7th, but everything thereafter is justified by it. It's a completely, lopsided logic. It doesn't make any sense. You're ignoring this entire history that comes before it. I mean, just the narrative of ceasefire, the word ceasefire and how it's been used. You've probably repeatedly heard there was a ceasefire on October 6th. Well, there's only a ceasefire on October 6th if it doesn't matter the Palestinians are being killed. And that's clearly the case. From the Western perspective, it doesn't matter that Palestinians are being killed. The fact that it was the deadliest year up until then for, I think it was children, Palestinian children in the West Bank. This is not a
Yeah,
ceasefire.
2023, you're right, yes.
They exist in, under occupation. There's no ceasefire under occupation. They exist under apartheid. You have millions of Palestinians who do not have control over their own lives. The argument will be made that, well, but Gaza wasn't occupied. That's not true. And in fact, the International Court of Justice found in July of last year that the blockade, the fact that Israel controlled Gaza by land, air, and sea, meant that de facto it was occupied by Israel. They do not have control over their own borders or resources. And so that entire aspect of the history is constantly ignored. If you look at the history, it's much, like I said earlier, it's much blame harder to just blame Hamas because you'd have to go back and say, but Hamas. The occupation predates Hamas. It's a lot harder to blame Hezbollah, which also came into existence in the 1980s because the occupation and the occupation of Lebanon predated the existence of Hezbollah. So if you want to go back, you have to go back to the truth, and that's essentially what we're trying to avoid. And the last thing I wanted to say on this is that ceasefire language, you're seeing it play out right now. Israel has killed an average of three Palestinians in Gaza per day since the ceasefire went into effect in January, but it's still called a ceasefire. Had on average three Israelis been killed every day, it would never be called a ceasefire.
Do you think we're at a turning point for media accountability when it comes to coverage of Gaza?
I want to say I hope so. You know, it's hard to say if we're, I think there's certainly data that would support the idea that we're in a watershed moment, right? Something has shifted. Something has changed. To a certain extent, it is, and there are people on the Israeli side who have made this argument, right? That what the Netanyahu government has done is actually, you know, undermine not only Israeli security, but Israel's image in the world. Because really it had massive favorability. Because especially in the West, not in the global South. In the global South, I mean, for a very long time, people who've actually been informed of this history take issue with the occupation, with the fact that Israel is an apartheid state. This has not been well received in the West amongst, you know, the basic sort of public opinions. But the fact that you're now seeing public opinion polls where less than half, right, a majority of Americans do not support Israel. That's huge. That's a very big shift. That's a very big difference. Does that mean that the media landscape has to shift? I think to some extent, their own legitimacy will be questioned if it doesn't.
And I'll end with this question, Asal. You being very outspoken on Western media coverage and Western bias, what do you hope readers and viewers take away? What would be your ultimate, let's say, call to action or piece of advice that you'd like to give?
Honestly, it's just to think critically of the information that we receive, to understand that there is likely a some kind of bias that goes behind it. And going back to the idea of manufacturing consent and the argument that was laid out in that 1988 book, part of it is because this is our media is a for-profit industry. Our news is for profit. And therefore, these platforms are beholden to certain interests. If they want access to, you know, if they want access to the president or to US officials, well, if you're really, really critical, it's going to make it a lot harder for you to have access. If you want advertisers to pay you, well, then you don't want to take a too critical point of view. You want to stay as, you know, sort of neutral and status quo as possible. And so just think about the interests that exist and think about, you know, how a simple change of words, a little adjustment in a headline can entirely change the meaning of it. And now think about how that's been repeated over and over for so many years to shape the way that we think.
And on that note, we'll leave it here. Asal Rad, thank you so much for taking the time to come on Real Talk. I really appreciate your time and thank you for coming on.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Thanks, Asal.